This is the Mike Shamari Show. My guest today is one of the greats in the world of modern jazz. His latest album, Bebop United, came out last Tuesday and is available now. Please welcome saxophonist Tom Scott.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
All right. Well, let's jump all the way back to the beginning, as I do with all these interviews that I do. How did you first get into music?
Well, it was pretty easy in my household because I am the son of two professional musicians. My father wrote music, well, worked his way up from the parking lot at NBC Radio on Sunset and Vine in Hollywood, corner. From the parking lot attendant up to an arranger and conductor for Bing Crosby and some of the other radio shows, and wrote a lot of the background music for Dragnet, Lassie, episodes of Twilight Zone. So there was always music in my house. My father was a composer by trade, and my mother had been a piano teacher and accompanist, and she also worked at NBC Radio. That's where they met. So for me, it was music, you know, throughout the house. No one forced me, however. I became obsessed with the folk music first, and Elvis Presley, because it was the middle 50s. And when I was about 9 years old, I started the clarinet. And my father very dutifully bought me a Benny Goodman record, wanting me to, you know, hear only the best. And I just fell in love with it. And that started me off on what some people have characterized as an obsession with music.
Yes. Well, how did your professional career begin?
Wow. Well, I started very young. I actually made money by the time I was 14 or 15, playing at country clubs and bar mitzvahs and weddings and, you know, any little social gathering where one of the others of us in this little band I was in knew a potential employer. So we would just work around where we could. And when I graduated high school, I did want to go to college. I went to USC, but the truth of the matter is, by that time, I had been playing in clubs, particularly a club called, two clubs, one called Dante's, which was in North Hollywood, and another one called the Baked Potato, which is still around, also in North Hollywood. In the middle to late 60s, I met some of the great musicians in the Hollywood studio scene at that time, including Dave Grusin and Howard Roberts and, oh my Lord, Sergio Mendez. Those are some of the people that I worked with very early on. Roger Kellaway, just an amazing number of great musicians hung out there. And so that's sort of where I cut my teeth, more or less. At the age of about 19, I was asked to join the Oliver Nelson Big Band and make a live CD at a now-defunct club in Los Angeles called Marty's on the Hill. And I recorded for 2 weeks there with the Oliver Nelson Big Band. And that was at the conclusion of that engagement, in which I was the solo tenor saxophone in a 17, 18-piece big band. The producer, Bob Thiel, who had founded Impulse Records and, you know, all of that wonderful music of Coltrane and various others on that label, he basically walked up to me and said, "Hey, kid, you want to make an album for me?" And I was like, "Yes, Mr. Thiel, I'd love to. Thank you, sir." You know, very, very respectful, and I'm just thrilled to be there and be part of it and be asked to do that.
Now, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so that led to the very first solo record I ever made, which was called Honeysuckle Breeze, in 1968.
And didn't you make a write music for a documentary?
True. Oh yeah. Now, on the writing, so that was the playing side. On the music writing side, I had continued to. I started, you know, transcribing solos off records when I was very young. I remember when Giant Steps was released in 1959. My father and I read a review of it in Hi-Fi Stereo magazine. So he went out and got me this record, and I couldn't believe how amazing it was. And I, like so many saxophone players then and now, sat down to transcribe the famous John Coltrane solo on Giant Steps. And then I worked my way up to big band arrangements. I was actually, you know, listening. I'd had a little Webcore phonograph, and I'd put the disc on and play like just a few seconds and then pound, peck around on the piano, try to figure out what the chords were. So by the time I was about 16, I think, I'd met some people, some documentary filmmakers who were making a film for the California school system on automated egg processing. It was called Eggs to Market,
mm-hmm.
And they asked me to do the musical score, which I did, and I used my young friends. Among them was Tim Weisberg, who was became a professional flutist, jazz flutist,
mm-hmm.
and who else was on it? I think he was the biggest name at that time.
Okay. Well, folks, we're talking with Tom Scott here on the Mike Shamari Show on Web Radio WCWP. Now, in the mid-1970s, you founded the L.A. Express. What were the days of the L.A. Express like?
The L.A. Express had a very interesting genesis because, like so many things that become popular, you don't plan them. They just kind of happen, and that was certainly the case here. I was playing every Tuesday night at the Baked Potato.
Mm-hmm.
This was about 1972. I was the house band on Tuesday nights, and it was the Tom Scott Quartet, and it was just saxophone, piano, bass, drums, playing very much straight-ahead jazz.
Mm-hmm.
I remember our bass player at that time couldn't make it or didn't want to do the gig anymore. So Max Bennett, who was had played upright bass on the Stan Kenton Band and with Peggy Lee and others, but had one of the few guys at that era to successfully make the transition to the electric bass, which, of course, was all the rage back then. You know, the acoustic bass took a little vacation for
mm-hmm.
a while.
Right.
In many of these, recording sessions and the electric players. So he had made the transition. He came in, and I got to give Max credit. He brought in the first two that kind of laid the groundwork for what would become the L.A. Express. And it was kind of an R&B-oriented tune, unlike the sort of jazz we were playing. But it was so much fun, and it had interesting chords, and we could improvise, but the most amazing thing is, in addition to the fact we had fun doing it, the people loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And we added more tunes like this. We added a guitar player to our band, so we became a five-piece group. And I can just tell you, from that day up until that time, we could have been playing on that Tuesday night for 20 to 50 people, or in 10 at the for the late show. Sometimes it didn't matter. It was just, but the audience grew and grew during that time. Once we started playing that kind of what we now know as kind of jazz fusion or R&B fusion,
mm-hmm.
The audience started to grow enormously. And in 6 months, I remember pulling up next to the club and seeing a line halfway down the block and going, "Wow. Obviously, something's happening here." So we talked about it, the guys in the band. We decided, well, let's try it. Let's adopt a name, and we became the L.A. Express. Once the band became established, we did a record kind of in at A&M on the weekends, A&M Studios on the which is on Sunset and La Brea.
Mm-hmm.
Hank Sicala, who was the engineer, the recording engineer for Lou Adler. It was Ode Records, the guy who eventually became my record producer, my record company. Hank recorded this in his spare time, and I had just made a record for Joni Mitchell, which was called For the Roses, and we worked very well together and had a great relationship. Well, she came into the club one night to hear our band, and Joni asked me, she says, "Listen, I have never," and I didn't realize this, she said, "I've never recorded with an actual band all at once." Her records up to that time, even though they had the semblance of a band on them, were done by her just going in and recording the tune herself using piano or guitar or dulcimer and singing, and then bringing in a bassist and sending him home, and bringing in a drummer and sending him home. So she suddenly like heard us, and then this could, we were a pretty cohesive band at that point, and she said, "I'd like to try this. Would the band consent to recording on my next project?" And I said, "Of course." And that became the record Court and Spark, which was then followed by a tour where we were the opening act for Joni Mitchell and accompanied her on the Court and Spark tour. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very heady time. We played. You never felt once like as if you could sit back and play less than your full game when you're working with Joni, because she goes out there and pours her heart and soul out. is such a great performing artist and lyricist and, you know, musician, that you just cannot do anything but your best work at all times, which is great. And that tour, of course, was chronicled in the recording Miles of Isles.
Okay. Folks, we're talking with Tom Scott here on the Mike Shamari Show on web radio WCWP. So we talked about the LA Express, but some of our listeners may know you from recording theme songs back in the late 70s and early 80s.
Right.
Shows like Starsky and Hutch and Family Ties.
Right. I wrote the themes for each of those shows. That's true. And played on a number of other themes that right around that period. I played on Streets of San Francisco and a couple of movie scores. I played on something funny going on. The Al Pacino movie where he was a lawyer. And Justice for All.
Okay. Called. Yeah.
And I played the theme on, well, several other movies. Anyway, it was a very productive time in that particular arena for me. I had been scoring individual episodes of television shows in the mid 70s. Quinn Martin was dominated the primetime television airwaves at that time with 1 hour dramas, mostly cop shows. Cannon. I wrote music for Cannon, different episodes, individual episodes of Cannon, Streets of San Francisco, Barnaby Jones, also another show with Glenn Ford called Cades County. And written the scores for two or three movies by that time. Uptown Saturday Night, the comedy with Sidney Poitier, directed and starring Sidney Poitier.
And Bill Cosby.
Another one, sorry?
And Bill Cosby.
And Bill Cosby and Richard Pryor, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, quite the cast.
So
I began to be quite busy in that area, but still I couldn't give up the horn, you know? Some people do that. They don't have a problem giving up their instrument if they start writing and composing. And it's a very lucrative area to get into, and the money's very good. But with that comes a great deal of responsibility and sometimes occasionally unpleasantness, although I've had a pretty good run, but sometimes you get into conflicts with a producer or the director, or sometimes you'll get into a situation where the producer director are fighting, not speaking to one another, and now you've got to walk in there and do the music for them and make them both happy, which is a difficult thing to do under those circumstances. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
We've all been in situations like that where the politics are just to make it impossible to do the job you'd like to do.
Yes.
But generally speaking, I've had a good run. And then of course, in those days, I was writing by hand on score paper, transposed, and handing it off to a copyist and walking into a studio with a marvelous orchestra made up of all the finest musicians in Los Angeles. God bless them, each and every one. And, of course, then the scene started to change with the advent of the synthesizer in the home studio. It's really revolutionized the whole, particularly television music. There are very few shows these days that have live music. There's some. I'm not saying none, but so many shows now are done by one or two or maybe three people in a home studio or in a small office somewhere. So it's changed the whole face of television. Television music, I'm not saying for the worse. It's for the worse in the sense that it eliminated an industry that was basically employing several hundred musicians on a regular basis. Just like everything else, of course, you know, the business has changed, and you've got to stay, keep on your feet and keep swinging.
In the mid to late 80s, you had some good albums that I really liked, like Streamlines and Flashpoint, which were part of your GRP days.
Right.
And what was it like recording those?
Oh, it was great. I think I was with, actually, GRP longer than any label. They kept me. They didn't kick me off. For reasons I can't explain, just, life sometimes takes odd turns. I've been on just about every record label from one time or another, but GRP was my home for about six or seven records, and a record company founded by two extraordinary gentlemen, one Dave Grusin, who was a tremendous film composer and pianist and a mentor of mine, helped me get my first, excuse me, Dave Grusin helped first get me my first writing assignment on television.
Mm-hmm.
And Larry Rosen, who was the business whiz behind that label, it was a great place. It felt like a family. There were a lot of compatriots on the label at one time or another, including Larry Carlton and Lee Ritenour, mm-hmm. and Korea. And sometimes we did tours, all-star tours together, all mm-hmm. of us, and it was always great fun. And so it was a real good time.
Yes, and some of you, like Dave Grusin and Lee Ritenour, you were part of the big GRP album back in the late 80s, GRP Super Live in Concert.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I guess that was kind of a culmination. And then that was followed a few years later by the GRP, in the 90s, by the GRP All-Star Big Band.
That's
which
right.
Of which I was the leader. And oh. we got two Grammys. A Grammy nomination and two Grammys over the course of its life.
Okay. Well, we're talking with Tom Scott here on the Mike Shamari Show on Web Radio WCWP, and I have to admit it's an honor to do this. Tell us about your new album, Bebop United.
Well, Bebop United is a sort of a milestone for me in a way, because I want to reestablish my roots. And I haven't done a so-called straight-ahead album in some time, and particularly a live one like this. This was recorded live in concert with some of my very favorite East Coast musicians. I went back east to ask some of my friends back there to join me, and I could not have asked for a better, more talented group of musicians. Phil Woods is on the record. Randy Brecker is on mm-hmm. the record. Jay Ashby on trombone, Ronnie Cuber on baritone sax, Gil Goldstein, the marvelous pianist and arranger, wrote all the arrangements for the Chris Botti Ballads album, and among other things, a mm-hmm. tremendous talent. Dwayne Berno on bass, and Willie Jones on drums, both of them alumni of the Roy Hargrove band.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a tremendous assemblage. I wrote some originals, and also arranged. I wrote all the arrangements, but they were either my tunes or some of my favorite straight-ahead jazz tunes from the past.
Mm-hmm.
And we just did four nights and let the improvisation go where it may, and chronicled the event with this CD, which is what I consider to be the best of the four nights.
And we will play a cut from Bebop United coming up after this interview. Well, what are your fans like?
What are my fans like?
Yes.
Well,
you must have plenty.
Well, I have people that write me and email me and occasionally stop me on the street. I would say, as a rule, they're quite a nice bunch, and I cannot tell you, to this day, you know, I'm almost 58, and to this day, it really makes me happy when somebody says, you know, your music helped get me through a time when I was down and so-and-so was happening, or, you know, your music gave me a lift when I needed it. That, boy, what better compliment could you ask for in life
mm-hmm.
than to actually help somebody you've never even met? I mean, I consider that a privilege, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I want to hold on to that card for a long time, because
okay.
that's a really, really special thing, and it's still makes me very happy. And I have a lot of musicians, a lot of saxophone players. They want to talk shop. What kind of reeds do I use?
Mm-hmm.
Mouthpieces, instruments, all that stuff, which of course now I put all that on my website.
Okay.
In the process of putting all that information on my website, which, as long as I'm there at this point, www.tomscottmusic.com.
Okay. So, you know what to do, folks. Open your Internet Explorer, your web, whatever your web browser is, put tomscottmusic.com and check it out.
There you go.
So we're down to our last question, and this is actually pretty long but a great interview. In your years of touring, what stands out memory-wise?
You know what? I have been so lucky. I've toured with some of the greatest people and played some of the greatest places. Let's see. I guess I should go from far to near. Going back to the first tour I did with Carole King, she did an album called Fantasy, and she was just a huge star at that time. We did a lot of concert halls throughout the United States with about a 10, 12-piece band in 1973. That was followed by almost a year with Joni Mitchell on tour. And that same year, I did a month or two with George Harrison on tour, mm-hmm. the first Beatle to do a solo concert outside of the Beatles. So you can only imagine what a brouhaha that was.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of those, you know, you walk onto a dark stadium, and suddenly you just hear this roar. it's totally surreal. We did that, you know, in 30 cities.
Mm.
So those kinds of experiences, you can't, you know, being on stage with a Beatle, you know what I mean? It's pretty mm-hmm. pretty hard to beat in the area of great concert moments. But I've also had wonderful ones recently. In fact, I made a movie with the Sidemen, the Funk Brothers, the famous Motown Sidemen who were unheralded for so many years. We did a concert a couple of years ago. They asked me to join them because I had been in the documentary about their history. In a concert in Toronto, outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
And we walked on stage, and the Motown guys were thrilled because for blocks, there was all you could see was faces. There must have been, I don't know, 60, 70,000 people. And Jack Ashford, the leader of the Motown guys, as I say, they'd made all these hits in Detroit back in the 60s, huge number of hits, and went unheralded for so long. And finally, they're getting their recognition. And now it's like, you know, 2004, and he hears this roar and he walks up and says, "We waited 40 years for this. Thank you very much." So I've had a great touring time. I just, you know, it's all about the music and the people. And what I've tried to do is surround myself with great musicians who are also wonderful people, and that's what makes it touring. Even though touring the you know, the suitcase and the every night in a different town can get a little tedious, it's very, very bearable and, in fact, fun if you've got the right people along.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tom, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Mike. I want to thank all the fans for listening and supporting the music. God bless you, and take care.
Okay. This has been Tom Scott here on The Mike Shamari Show, and up next, something from Bebop United.